interview with Associate Justice I. Beverly Lake Jr. of the North Carolina Supreme Court in his Raleigh chambers on Tuesday, June the 27, 1995, for the Southern Oral History Program series, The North Carolina Politics Project. This is cassette number 6.27.95-BL.
Okay, Justice Lake, if I could ask to start, can you give me a sense in the mid-60s of how you're practicing law in Raleigh, how you might have looked forward with your own personal career? Did you anticipate moving into politics? Did you...
Well, certainly not at that time. I thought perhaps that I might sometime in the distant future, but I was heavily engaged in the law practice at the time and really didn't give any consideration to my entry into politics at that point in time. My father was still very much involved in the arena, and I think it was pretty obvious you can't have father and son running at the same time. So I would say not at that time, but the thought had crossed my mind for the future.
Let me test very quickly. Do you recall a reaction in the mid-60s to the unfolding civil rights affairs? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and voting rights of 65. Mm-hmm. How had that by the mid-60s, what kind of impression had those developments made on you, and how did you see that perhaps impacting the state's future political arena, or scene, excuse me?
Well, I think the Civil Rights Act of 64 came as a shock, well, the 65 Voting Rights Act as well, as a shock really to the system, the overall governmental structure in North Carolina. As well as elsewhere, of course, and I don't really recall any personal feelings beyond the general dismay, I think, that was prevalent throughout the bar, and there was some considerable discussion. I seem to recall about the constitutionality of both and within the legal circles at the time. So beyond that, it was new, something we were certainly interested in vitally, and it was unproven, untested, and we didn't know, but we had considerable concern.
By the mid-60s, would you already have had ties with the State Democratic Party, or perhaps the party here in Raleigh?
Yes. Yes, I was. Well, I was in the. I was a young Democrat in the YDCs, and I represented the conservative wing of the Democratic Party at that time. I didn't. That's not to say I was the representative, but I was in that wing of the party. I guess I've always been a conservative, but we probably agree on a lot of things. Yes, I had roles in the Jefferson Jackson Day dinners and bringing speakers in, making arrangements. I was very active in the Democratic Party.
Did you participate in Bob Scott's 68 campaign, or did you...
No, I didn't. I think at that time I was very heavily involved in the law practice with the new firm of Boyce, Lake & Burns at that time. My father had gone on to the Supreme Court. I was not involved in Bob Scott's campaign. I like Bob very much.
Back then, in the state being so heavily Democratic, would it have been a common thing to know much at all, really, about sort of who was driving the state's Republican Party back in those days? Did you have much of a sense of that?
No, not at all. Gave it very little thought. We really had two parties within the Democratic Party. We had the liberal and the conservative wings. So,
can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it's virtually what we have now with the two-party system. The Republicans really were not a factor in statewide politics. There were pockets, of course, on the local level where they had some influence, but basically it was a Democratic state. The Democrats ran the show, and it was just a fight between the two wings, liberal and conservative, and that really came to the forefront in the 1950 Willie Smith, Frank Graham senatorial race. That's when that was the line of demarcation, I think. Whoever won the Democratic primary for governor was the next governor.
Would you have known Jesse Helms is an emerging figure in the late, across the 60s, in 57 to 61, he's on the city council, and then, of course, he moves over to WRAL for the next 12 years.
Yes, I got to know Jesse when he was with WRAL and knew him quite well at that time. I went to see him frequently. We discussed politics in general and specifically. Jesse was a strong supporter of my father's in 1960, and I would say yes. Since the late 50s, I've been in close touch with Jesse. He was a Democrat, of course, at that time.
Can you describe your move over to the Attorney General's office, and then I'll ask a question or two about the work there.
I went with the Attorney General in early 69, primarily because Bob Morgan was the Attorney General at the time. He had won, and you ask about the 68 election. I was primarily involved in Bob Morgan's race, and I did some work for Mel Broughton. Mel Broughton, you know, ran against Bob Scott, so... And Mel was in the more conservative wing of the party. And, of course, Bob Morgan had been my father's campaign manager in 1960. So I wanted to get in the AG's office, and I thought Bob was going to do fine things and break new ground, and I wanted to be a part of it. And I was.
You know, I realize I forgot to ask one further question about the 68 election cycle, and that was... What did folks in North Carolina make of Reginald Hawkins' campaign? Because he actually got 20% of the vote in the Democratic primary.
What year was that? I don't even...
68.
That's right. I'd forgotten that. I haven't thought about Reginald in a long time. That was quite a showing. I don't recall anything specifically about his fine showing at that time, but it if he got that vote, it's certainly very significant.
Were there particular political pressures flowing through the Attorney General's office during your first few years there that you remember, issues that were filtering, say, out of the governor's office down into the Attorney General's office, special matters of great concern to the governor?
Well, at the first 2 years, I was involved in the revenue department and had some contact with the General Assembly, not much, but I don't recall anything specifically at that time. Later, when my last 5 years with the AG was over at the Utilities Commission, I was representing the public for the Attorney General against the rate. In the rate cases against the power companies and so forth. But at that time, we became much more aware of the overall political environment, and the governor's office was concerned. We were moving then toward the oil embargo and a lot of things that came about in the early 70s. We had had some real wars over there with the power companies and the telephone companies, and multi-million-dollar cases that required quite a bit of effort. And that carried through my last 5 years with the AG's office. But yes, the we became aware of the fact that our boss, Bob Morgan, as I knew he would be, was very much involved in politics and was not necessarily going to remain AG for the rest of his life. In fact, we would have been astounded if he had indicated that desire. In fact, I think there was quite a move on for Bob Morgan to run for governor, and he was given it serious consideration in 72, I believe. Decided to wait to 74.
There were some rumors that floated in the press around 74 that you might run for the Attorney General slot. How did your thinking work out on that question?
Well, I'm surprised that you even knew about that. Yes, when Bob Morgan was obviously moving on to the U.S. Senate, quite a few of us decided we would like to succeed Bob Morgan and try to carry on some of the good things that he'd started. That was my motivation. I was very concerned about the public utilities in North Carolina and trying to make sure the people were adequately represented. We were normally outgunned and tremendously outspent in all of these rate cases. I guess I was I think I still am right much of a populist along with my conservative philosophy. I certainly was not big business. I just wanted really to get more involved in many of the things that we had been concerned with for years, not just in the utilities arena, but across the board. Education was something that I was vitally interested in and got somewhat involved in later on. But I think we had about eight candidates that were really in contention. Of course, the next AG was going to be picked by the Democratic Executive Committee. And I think at that time, that was pretty well controlled by the liberal wing of the party. I know Burley Mitchell was interested in it at the time. Kitch Josie, who is now deceased, was very, very interested in it. Along with Rufus Edmiston. Rufus, of course, won. I think probably it's just as well that it worked out that way.
Who would have been actively involved in this decision making when you say the Democratic Executive Committee? You're thinking of whom?
I don't recall anybody specifically. I don't remember who made up the board. The impression I had at the time and still have is that it was I had a few friends on there, but I didn't think I had enough to really carry the day.
Let me take you back to a couple of years prior to 74 and ask about the 72 Holzhauser win. What recollections do you have of what drove that election?
Well, I think many of the things that drove that election drove the 94 election. I think there were many parallels. We saw a lot of excesses in government. The Democrats had not performed well, and primarily at the national level. And I think that was a general bleed down to the state level. We had a good candidate in Jesse Helms. I think he was probably a better candidate then than he has been recently. He seemed to relate well to the people, and Holzhauser had a good message, but his campaign suffered very like mine in 1980. It was almost totally ignored by the press. Nobody gave him a chance. They did pay some considerable attention to Jesse Helms, but not much to Jim Holzhauser. And I've heard it remarked many times. I've never asked him about it, but I saw him on TV that night, the night he won, and the general comment is that he was the most surprised person in the room from the way he looked and responded. He certainly came on to, and made a remarkable record as governor, I think, and got a number of things accomplished. It was a good change of pace. I don't remember much about his campaign, but I do his administration.
Are there things you can tell me about his tenure in Raleigh that come to mind when you think about those 4 years?
Well, he took part quite extensively in the problems we were having with energy in general, the oil embargo, and the problems with the utilities. He was concerned, as I was, that our great power companies here in this state would run out of fuel. We were concerned with the coal supply. We were concerned with the pollutants that would be involved there. Concerned with nuclear power. One of my concerns, well, I had two great concerns at that time with nuclear power, and one was the cost of it. The cost was just totally out of hand. It was astronomical, and we couldn't afford it. And the other was a supply of the reported supply of yellow cake to make uranium fuel in this country, and it appeared that we might be confined to that. And the power companies were just totally bent toward growth. They were trying to expand and grow at 10 times I think a reasonable rate. And that's why they tried to build four units out at Sharon Harris, and only one of them got built. But they were funding and getting rates set to establish four. And ultimately, the ratepayers, the common man, had to pay for that management mistake. But they were told, I told them that over there when I was in the AG's office, and fought them for about 4 years on that. Holzhauser was involved in that, not on a daily basis, but certainly, I would say, weekly, monthly. I remember he and I flew to Washington one time to talk to the Federal Power Commission. I presented him to the commission, and he gave some good testimony. We almost got killed coming back to North Carolina, but...
How was that?
We were in a light little highway plane that I think was sturdy by comparison to the Wright Brothers plane. We got the worst thunderstorm I ever saw at that altitude. So we were on and off the ceiling of that plane and just as sick as we could be, and thought we were going to die, and sometimes afraid we weren't.
Across the years in the mid-70s, the Congressional Club is emerging. Formed in 73 by Tom Ellis to retire Jesse Helms' 72 campaign debt, of course. Can you tell me about... What can you tell me about that story, about the early, those first couple years of the Congressional Club? how they operated, who the key players were, your connections to them, if any, what you knew of these folks?
Well, in the early days, let me preface by saying I didn't know much. In the early days, I think the club as such, whatever it meant at that time, I was not a member, but I did make some small contributions from time to time, nothing over $100 in a year. But I went to a number of the dinners and events, and at that time the club was, I think, very well oriented to the issues and to the people that were a part of the club, the loyal supporters. As years, and they were close to Jesse. I think Jesse was close to the club, and the club to Jesse. The club has always been run by Tom Ellis, and then he brought Carter Wren on. I don't remember exactly when Carter Wren came on in his current position, but really the club was the baby of Tom Ellis, and Tom, of course, was very close. Tom played a very key role in my father's campaigns in 60 and 64. I don't know what really happened to the philosophy in the club. I think possibly the two things, the need to raise a lot of money to fight the opposition, keep up with the opposition. And then money became too important. That was something that Tom and Carter and I disagreed about in my 1980 race for governor. I knew money was important. There was a statement floating around in those days that you had to have three things to run a political campaign. You had to have a candidate, you had to have an organization, you had to have money. And the least important was a candidate. And the most important was money. Well, you know, when you, if that's true, then we've reached a sorry state of affairs. If that ever becomes true, it's a disaster. But the club began to focus, I think, too much on money and too little on the quality of the campaigns that were being run. It got away from the reciprocal closeness to the people that contributed locally to the club. Not just for Jesse. I mean, it was the club was involved in other things in those days, and it was a philosophy that those people were concerned with and believed in. And so that very generally is what I think happened. I don't know anything about the recent split between Jesse and the club. My thought is that Jesse has finally, and I know Jesse and I discussed through the years, that his dissatisfaction with the fundraising letters, the way they went out, they were written by somebody that didn't know how to change his thinking at all. I mean, you know, a letter written in 1974 would appear again in 1976, I mean, almost verbatim, and way too long, and always asking for money, money. Jesse, I think, finally got tired of the fact that about 80 to 85% of every dollar raised went to the club for support and more fundraising rather than to any campaign or to any cause.
Can you tell me about Tom Ellis? Sort of how he saw the club.
How he saw it?
What he hoped for it probably in its early days. Did he have ambitions to make it what it became, even from the earliest days, as you can recall? Or
I really don't know, because I didn't talk to Tom about it in those days. I don't think I did. He probably initially formed it to do just what we know they say it was formed for, to retire the 72 debt. And that was more successful than necessary, so I guess then the seed was planted and it went from there. I think at that time, too, they reasonably looked ahead toward Jesse's reelection campaign and started, after the debt was retired, building for that. And then they got involved in other people's campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll ask about those as we move forward, but I want to ask also about, what was your sense of what the Holzhauser election meant to the state Democratic Party? Jim Hunt, of course, was the lieutenant governor in those years.
Well, I think it was widely viewed as a fluke. I think there was some concern until Watergate, and then no concern at all. I think those governors could only serve for 4 years at that time, and Jim Hunt was solidly in control of the Democratic Party and the legislature, from what I heard when I got there in 76. Lieutenant Governor, Governor Hunt, ruled with a rather iron hand. I remember when I was Assistant Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General at the time, and Lieutenant Governor Hunt had come out with a utility reform package. And I had another approach in mind. I went over and spoke to a joint Senate House committee considering this, and it was a very volatile, heated issue. The governor's bill was called the Omnibus Utility Reform Act, as I recall, and I went over and testified basically against it, and shot right many holes in it. The governor called me over, I think, the next day, and said, you know, he was certainly upset and displeased that I had ruined his bill, and I told him I didn't perceive that I had really ruined his bill, that perhaps I had helped it some, and I think something better did come of it. But that was the first time that Jim Hunt and I had really talked, other than in a receiving line. Remember when at Holzhauser's inaugural, I shook hands with the Lieutenant Governor, Governor Hunt first, and then the governor. I told Jim Hunt, I said, if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know. Well, he didn't until after that talk on his utility bill. And then we tried to work together. But he told me that meeting that he was going to be the next governor of North Carolina, and he wanted me, in effect, to get in line. And We got along quite well while I was in the early days of my two terms in the Senate. Well, not just the early days, I think end of the second term as well. I sponsored a number of his key bills, floor managed them through the Senate. So to that extent, I got on board, but I didn't hesitate to let him know when I thought he was wrong. I think he appreciated it. We've always, even when I was running against him for governor, we've always been friendly. I think very highly of him.
Can you tell me a little bit about your motives for running for the state Senate, what you thought were the key issues that you hoped to attend to when you got to Raleigh?
Well, I really should have gone back and pulled some of my old brochures, but I was concerned with the utility situation. I thought the people were basically being ripped off, and they were. Wanted to come forward with a real utility reform package, which I did introduce and got some enacted. I was concerned with education and what I perceived to be the failure in education. I wanted to do something about the then perceived serious problem in discipline in the public schools and the curriculum. I thought too much money was going into physical plant and frills. It still is. Some things never change. I wanted to do something about the burgeoning crime problem. I think those three were probably the main issues that I had in mind when I ran.
So it sounds from that description that your sense by, say, 76 in your first campaign is that this is not a situation where you're running to do a better job in a situation where things are moving along in a fairly acceptable way, but rather you had some fairly serious concerns about things and
yes.
The trajectory of certain questions.
Right.
The state's
right.
Development. What are some of your sharpest impressions from your years in Raleigh, how politics got done there in the Senate?
Well, back in the old days, I used to watch it being done at the heart of government in Raleigh down at the Sir Walter Hotel. That was when the legislature was in this building right across the street here in the Capitol. When I was in the Attorney General's office, I went over there and wrote bills for them and gave them advice and spoke to committees. And I didn't have that high a regard generally for the legislature. I did for certain individuals in it, but I thought many of them over there were basically party boys and didn't know what they were doing. I think this is true generally with anything. When you really get in it and get on the inside, your perspective changes. I found out early on that a lot was done in those receptions and dinners and the general entertainment of the evening. A lot of business of the people was handled and quite effectively in some instances. There were still those party boys and people that didn't know what they were doing over there. There was no real shortage of that. I don't mean to say I thought they were all knights in shining armor when I got there, but I did perceive it differently, and I was given to understand when I got there that because of my experience primarily in the Attorney General's office, I was going to be given a leadership role, which I welcomed. And they put me in charge of the Senate Public Utilities and Energy Committee. And then my second term, I was chairman of Judiciary too. So I think I did early on get to the point where I found the people I could work with, including Governor Hunt, and we got some good things done.
Do you have any specific recollections about the 1976 race between, for lieutenant governor, between Jimmy Green and Howard Lee?
Was that 76? I guess it was. I really don't remember much about that. I got to know Jimmy Green right after that campaign. I didn't know him really until I got to the Senate. I can't recall very much about that campaign.
I guess outside of Reginald Hawkins' 68 and 72 campaigns for governor, that probably would have been the first statewide run by black North Americans.
Right. Well, I do remember, now that I think about it, that he did extremely well and was widely liked, I think. I don't remember what his vote was, but I think it was reasonably close. And I do like Howard. Howard's I don't think Howard's out of politics by any means. Howard and I worked together well when he was mayor of Chapel Hill. And I always enjoyed Howard when he was Secretary of
Community Development, I think it was renamed ultimately.
Yeah, that's right. They've changed that around so much, I can't remember. But I saw Howard right much in those days.
Yeah, sure. Let me turn to this very important highlight point on the timeline as we survey your political career. Mm-hmm. And in October of 79, the day comes where you make the decision to cross over and run for governor as a Republican. Can you sort of give me the foundation of your thinking that led up to that move? How that came to pass?
Well, I think it was an outgrowth of things that I had been observing almost from the beginning of my awareness of politics. As I said, I've always been a conservative, and at that time I had perceived, I think, quite a change in the political spectrum in North Carolina and nationally. The the 72 election had made quite an impact on me. I think some of the issues that we were concerned with in the Senate at the time made an impact. I just did not, I didn't like the way I thought the country was going at that time. And it was quite a difficult decision because I'd been a Democrat all my life, my father all his life. We'd come from a Democratic family. My great-grandfather was a Democratic congressman from Kentucky. We just always thought in terms of Democratic party politics, but the party was not not what I had grown up with, not the party that I had participated in as a member of the YDC and on beyond that through two Senate campaigns, my Senate campaigns. I had been dissatisfied with things prior to that that time, and I can't point to any one event. I remember, and I don't even remember. I don't remember what this subject was, but I was debating something on the floor of the Senate. All I remember was when I sat down, a gentleman on the back row leaned forward and whispered, "Why don't you change your party registration? Why don't you become a Republican?" And evidently he mentioned it to a number of other people too, so they began to call, and one thing led to another, and with a great deal of concern, not that I was failing any responsibility or duty, but my concern that I was hurting some feelings and friends, I did decide to go ahead and make the change and step from a leadership position in the Democratic Party to a very tenuous position in the Republican Party, not knowing at all how I might be really accepted.
When this courting began and these phone calls began, people would contact you in this effort to encourage you to switch over. What sorts of arguments did people make? What kinds of things did they say that they thought seemed most persuasive in their effort to persuade you?
Well, they said they thought the my philosophy was clearly Republican now. My philosophy was the same as it always had been, but it had, I guess, come to the attention, perhaps for the first time, of certain people. My 4 years in the Senate, they said I had an opportunity to do more in the Republican Party than I did in the Democratic Party for that philosophy, for the things I believed in, the things I was concerned about. They said that you know, the leadership of the Democratic Party doesn't really want you where you are now, and I thought that was generally true, even though I could probably have held on and maybe even advanced further in the Democratic Party. I think the time was coming when my philosophy would not have prevailed in the Democratic Party, as it has not for a number of other people. So I can't, again, remember any great dynamic words from anybody, but just a combination of things. I discussed it considerably with my father, for example, and who's always given me good political advice, and a number of other friends. Surprisingly, many people in the Democratic Party said they thought it was the right thing for me to do at the time. And I was surprised that a number of Republicans said the same thing. Of course, I think they were looking for somebody to run against Jim Hunt at the time. And that had to figure into it. And I was not particularly adverse to running against Jim Hunt at the time. Even though I knew very well it was a tremendous uphill battle. I guess I have that one distinction of being the first to run against an incumbent governor.
What impact on your thinking in this context did the surprise GOP primary victory of Ronald Reagan with Congressional Club backing in 76 have?
Well, that certainly had an impact, and the club was perceived as a real force in those days because those were the glory days of the club, and that was when the club was really performing a great service. The club could raise money. I think one clear failure in their ability to raise money was in my race for governor. And of course, I think too little consideration was given to the fact that it's hard to raise money in state when you're running against a sitting governor. So I think I ended up raising $343,000. Governor Hunt raised something over $7 million and had all the advantage of incumbency to go along with it. Now, at the same time, the club raised, and this was part of our problem, I was running with John East and Bill Coby. Bill Coby's race hurt me considerably because he was running against my friend Jim.